All right. Now, what are the dangers of clinging to an outworn formula, an incorrect political idea, which was correct under one historical context and then was outmoded as a result of the course of historical development? In the resolution, the same resolution of the Second World Congress after reunification, we see examples of what the result can be, as I say, of hanging on to formulas that are no longer applicable. For example, in the resolution, the same resolution on the Sino-Soviet conflict cited above, unwarranted and false conclusions are drawn over the alleged differences between the Peking and Moscow bureaucracy. Now let me cite one example. They say the new relationship of forces on a world scale, one of the consequences of the new relationship of forces on a world scale is that the Maoist group itself, however fixed its bureaucratic pattern of thinking and practice may be, is not at all merely repeating the policies and views of Stalin. They display a decisive difference with Stalin, for example, in the key concept of building socialism in one country, advancing instead the idea of uninterrupted revolution, particularly since the disastrous experience of the Great Leap Forward, when Mao set out to build communism in one country, and at a faster rate than either Stalin or Khrushchev, the Chinese leaders have been emphasizing the need for socialism to triumph in other countries. Now here, if I understand them, they're attempting to draw a parallel between the Maoist version, at least their verbal advancement of the idea of uninterrupted revolution, with that of permanent revolution. Now, if that was true, that would mark a very important change in the physiognomy of Maoism. You'd be able to swallow some of his thoughts if that were true. Now you gag on him, huh? The uninterrupted revolution. If it was true, we would have to revise our position on Maoism. We would have to abandon the call for political revolution. If Maoism has displayed a decisive difference on the question of building socialism in one country and the uninterrupted revolution, socialism in one country, that's the cesspool from which all the poison of Stalinism has welled up over the entire working class movement of the world. The source, the fountainhead, is socialism. And I would say that we would have to welcome Mao with open arms and say, boy, if you won't join us, we'll join you. But let's take a little closer look before we leave. Is the Maoist concept of uninterrupted revolution analogous to the Trotskyist theory of permanent revolution? In an article that I wrote for ISR, A Mao-Stalin Rift, Myth or Fact, I quoted from a pamphlet written by Chen Potao. Now, Chen Potao is a leading theoretician of the Chinese Communist Party. Not only that, he is probably the foremost foremost exponent of Mao thought in China. He's one of the left, along with Mao's wife, presumably, the left of the left wing of the Cultural Revolution. And he's an authority, an unimpeachable authority. On Maoism, not on Leninism. In a pamphlet entitled Mao Zedong on the Chinese Revolution, written in 1951, Chen Po-ta observes that, and I quote, "In the light of the concrete conditions in China, Mao Zedong developed the teachings of Lenin and Stalin regarding the continuous development of the bourgeois democratic revolution." And then, quoting Mao, he adds, "We advocate the theory of the continuous development of revolution, but not the Trotskyist theory of permanent revolution. We stand for the attainment of socialism through all the necessary stages of the democratic republic. We are opposed to Taylorism, but we are also opposed to adventurism and ultra-revolutionism." At his age, he can be opposed to all kinds of Taylorism, too. Thus spake Mao. But that was in 1951. Has there been any change between then and now? The World Congress Resolution was adopted after the Indonesian catastrophe of 1965. And the resolution deals in some detail with that event. And let me quote from the resolution. That even after the anti-communist offensive of the generals was unleashed, that is in Indonesia, the leadership of the Indonesian Communist Party refrained from calling upon the masses for an all-out reply and continued to bank on Sukarno, although he was becoming an outright captive of the army. Overwhelmed by the repression, confronted with a choice between political suicide and a turn toward guerrilla warfare, the leading faction of the Indonesian Communist Party, at least those who survived the October 1965 disaster, seem to have chosen the latter alternative. This choice was facilitated by the fact that parallel to its line of class collaboration, an opposite tendency existed in the ideology of the Indonesian CP. Some of its concepts are rather close to the Chinese concepts of the uninterrupted revolution. The Indonesian CP constantly explained that the peasants are the fundamental revolutionary force, and even in the democratic revolution, the leading role belongs to the workers and peasants, and that the formation of the government of the people's democracy type constituted its immediate aim. But these contradictions were confined within a strategic line of revolution by stages, within a policy of coalition with the national bourgeoisie headed by Sukarno. This led the aided leadership to put brakes on the mass movement, to hold the masses prisoner to NAPCOM, that is the National Front of the three main political groupings, the Sukarno Nationalists, the Muslim religious teachers, and the Communist Party. This paved the way to the bitter defeat suffered by the biggest Communist Party in the capitalist world. In other words, application of the Maoist concept of the uninterrupted revolution in Indonesia led to the slaughter of the Indonesian Communist Party, led to the greatest defeat on the international scale since the defeat of the working class of Germany in 1936. That's without exaggeration. 300,000, some 300,000 members of the Communist Party slaughtered. That's a high price to pay for the uninterrupted revolution, a la Mao, a native of the Indonesian Communist Party. Well, then how can you speak in the same, or how can you even intonate that the Maoist verbal words fail me? But even more recently, The Communist Party of Peru, last year, published a savage diatribe against Trotskyism, centering on what? An attack on our concept of permanent revolution, as advocated and applied by the Fourth International Group in that country. They counterposed to it the Maoist formula of uninterrupted revolution, which is spelled out in precise detail and adds up to the old Stalinist formula of the revolution in stages. In other words, they say that in Peru, the democratic revolution is on the order of the day. That's the stage. The democratic revolution in which the national patriotic bourgeoisie is conducting a struggle for national liberation against American imperialism. And that the revolution in Peru would have to go through then the stage of the establishment of a bourgeois democratic republic, then of a labor movement and a communist party in opposition, to begin the struggle for the proletarian revolution at a much later stage. The revolutionary stage. Xinhua, which is the news service of the Maoists, published this complete text of this document without comment. And Xinhua doesn't publish anything that Mao doesn't approve of. Nothing. And if my memory serves me right, considered it important enough to republish it in Peking Review. But an even more important question than permanent revolution versus uninterrupted revolution of the Maoist variety is the question that we have always considered of decisive significance. That is the theory of socialism in one country. If it is true, as the 1965 resolution affirms, that the Maoist group, quote, displays a decisive difference with Stalin in the key concept of building socialism in one country, unquote, it would require, in my opinion, a fundamental and basic revision of our view not only of Maoism, but of Stalinism on a world scale. The theory of socialism in one country marked the basic revision of Marxism and provided the ideological framework for the transition from revolutionary socialism to national reformism. That has always been our position. That was the position of Trotsky. The theory of socialism in one country is not Marxist, it's anti-Marxist. It's not proletarian, it's petty bourgeois. It's not revolutionary, it's reformist. And any tendency in the world today that subscribes to this theory is, in my opinion, Stalinist of one degree or another. That doesn't mean that all Stalinist parties are the same. Oh, no, there's some like the Chinese and Moscow and Kremlin are almost on the point of military warfare. But that doesn't make Mao any less a Stalinist than the Kremlin. In the ideological sphere, in the sphere of ideas and of practice, if you please, those tendencies, whether they're at the head of workers' states or whether they exist as opposition parties in capitalist countries or in semi-colonial countries, that subscribe to the theory of socialism in one country occupy the place that the social democracy did prior to World War I and after. Social reformism, national reform. Now, this is the subject for my next talk, beginning with the question of socialism in one country and developing some other points on Stalinism as a whole whether it exists, whether it doesn't exist, how does it exist, what forms does it exist, which we'll pursue in the next lecture.
I have one announcement, and then we'll begin the question period. People should feel free to comment and to make questions. Just keep it under a few minutes in length, 2 or 3 minutes. The announcement is that comrades must clear their own dishes at mealtime, so there's been a problem with that. So comrades, remember to bus them to the fireside of the cafeteria. We're ready for questions and comments.
Clarify the concept of centrism, which I take it the origin of the bureaucratic census designation was that the Stalin faction lay in the center between the Bukharian rightists on one side and the left opposition on the other side. And centrist to me is always kind of an empty term unless it's centrist in relation to something else on both sides.
Well, that's generally correct. In the early period, especially after the death of Lenin, the beginning of the rise, beginning of the development of bureaucracy, the opposing tendencies developed inside, not only inside the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, but a reflection of the antagonisms that began to develop in the Soviet state itself. And you had a right wing, headed by Bukharin, Tomsky, Rogoff, the left opposition, Trotsky's opposition. There were a number of oppositions in between. And Stalin, who was the head of the centrist, or head of the centrist tendency in the party. And bureaucratic centrism, as distinct from centrism of the more classical type that we witnessed in the period prior to the Russian Revolution, or even in the recent period, the period since then, was a centrism which developed on the basis of a workers' state. They had state power. This centrist bureaucracy under Stalin rested on the basis of a victorious workers' revolution, dictatorship of the proletariat. And the generation of the state led to the development of bureaucratic tendency, and so the designation politically was bureaucratic centrism. Yeah, that's right. How you find centrism? We have always speculated, and we still speculate, what will the course of revolutionary development be in this country? Will it be when a radicalization occurs, that is a wide, deep radicalization involving the working class and other sections of the population? Will the workers move towards reformism first, as the first stage of the radicalization? Will they move directly to the most revolutionary tendency, that is Trotskyism? Or will a new centrist formation, standing somewhere between the social democracy and revolutionary socialism, arise in which they're able to capture a large part of the radicalized masses? Centrist tendencies exist today. I would characterize, for example, international socialism as a centrist tendency in the American working political movement. Standing somewhere between Trotskyism and social democracy. We'll go into the question of Stalinism. What Stalinism today represents in those countries in which it's not in power. And there, I think, we can speculate about some very interesting...
Could you go into the difference between bonapartism and bureaucratic centrism? My concept of bonapartism is the arbiter of class conflict, resting between classes, personified by a single individual. Your definition of bureaucratic centrism was that it arbitrated the conflict between the proletariat and the peasantry and the Soviet Union, and between the workers' state and the world capitalist state outside of the Soviet Union. So would you go into the differences between those two terms?
Well, you have first the question of the party. Now, when Trotsky called for the, when he designated this formation of bureaucratic centers, called for the reform of the party, he viewed as the party as the indispensable instrument without which there could be no talk of the reform of the state. See, because the party was a decisive factor in controlling the state apparatus. In fact, the two merged very close together. It is when he decided that the party was no longer a viable instrument, he said the party was dead, he said there no longer exists any such instrument as the party to intervene, to reform the state, and therefore we have to have a political revolution and a new party, you see. The state itself, that is the government. You could say at one time reflected the centrism of the bureaucracy and the party, in that it acted as an arbiter between the two antagonistic classes in the Soviet Union, the working class and the peasantry. Remember, in Russia, the working class was a very small minority, overwhelming majority at the time of the revolution were peasants, not workers. And they acted as an arbiter between the interests of the Soviet Union and the world working class movement, subordinating, which is a part of our discussion for tomorrow, subordinating the Communist International, which was established for the express purpose of providing the general staff for the world revolution, of subordinating it into an instrument of defense of the interests of the Soviet bureaucracy against the interests of the advance of the world revolution. It supported itself on these two forces. Now, Bonapartism, they refers to the role of this centrist bureaucracy as the apparatus of the state. A totalitarian state apparatus, balancing itself upon the two classes, balancing itself upon the Soviet Union and the world working class, representing the interests of world imperialism on the one hand, and defending the property forms established by the October Revolution on the other. There's a dual contradictory character, moving, zigzagging left and right, but the general movement was always to the right, never returning to the point on the left, this most leftward point, always moving further and further to the right. That generally is the difference.
To my knowledge, the Vietnamese Communist Party held the National Democratic Revolution, which is a common period. What is our position on that? We call for a political revolution against the Chinese,
oh no. The Vietnamese now are, and we call for defense of Vietnam against the imperialist attack. In the same sense, we call for defense of the Soviet Union during the World War, during World War II. Defense of the Soviet, although we subordinate, see, the Trotsky said we subordinate our political opposition to the defense of the state against imperialism. Now we ought to be clear on this. The Vietnamese Communist Party is not a Trotskyist party. It's not a revolutionary Marxist party. It's impregnated with Stalinism, with the whole concept of the revolution in stages, of the democratic revolution, of coalition government, so forth and so on. But we support it despite all of these differences that we had. And at another stage, these differences may loom as important and decisive for us. But at this stage, our main concern is support of that revolution against American imperialism. and getting the troops the hell out of there, because our main enemy, the American imperialism, not the Vietnamese Communist Party, they're very small potatoes on a world scale. They play no role.
Yeah, question,
very little, except ideologues.
The question centers regarding the Vietnamese Communist Party. Is it appropriate in terming reevaluation of the Vietnamese movement and the whole world of guerrilla warfare, but it wasn't exactly clear as to what they posed as an alternative, either guerrilla warfare or what national reform. I'm not sure. So could you characterize what we would say as the Cuban Communist Party's tendency and what type of direction it has?
I deliberately left the Cuban development out of this. You'll probably have noted that, because it would only have complicated the analysis I had tried. They're not included in, they were not a Stalinist party. In fact, it demonstrated the correctness of what the old man wrote in the transition program, you see. That is, the old man foresaw that under very unique and extraordinary circumstances that it was possible. He did not exclude the possibility of a Stalinist party taking power. There is a section in the transitional program, he says, where under very unique and extraordinary circumstances, even a Stalinist party can take power, you see. So that this is not, the allusion to that we'd have to revise our position on Stalinism, because the Yugoslav CP took power or the Chinese CP. The Chinese, that's a big question in itself, you see. I don't believe, for example, that there was any break with Stalin between Mao and Stalin. I didn't see any necessity for it. If you understand Stalinism as a tendency which is concerned primarily with the preservation of the position and power of the bureaucracy, and the fact that it can go through some rather sharp zigzag, left or right, depending upon where the interests of the bureaucracy lie. That in the period of the Chinese Revolution, 1948-1949, decisive period, was the period of the Cold War. And Stalin and the Stalinists looked with horror on the establishment of a pro-American imperialist government in China under Chiang Kai-shek, which would mean he'd be confronted with the most powerful imperialist power in the world on his eastern front, and the capitalist countries of Europe organized under the Marshall Plan on his western front, on the two fronts. And so it's not true that he put the halter on Mao, in my opinion. It is true that he was opposed to the establishment of a workers' state, the overthrow of capitalism. And for a number of years in China, they did not establish a workers' state. They said they were opposed to it. They said that we have capitalism here, but controlled capital. We were only against the comprador capitalist. That is, the Chiang Kai-shek capitalists, but the national and patriotic capitalists, they preserved capitalist property relations. It was only after the Korean development that they proceeded to nationalize property in China and establish for the first time a deformed workers' state. You see, so it's not true. Now, in Cuba, my heart bleeds for those Cuban people. Look at the position that they're in. A little country of, 6 million people, situated in a monoculture, that is, the cultivation of sugar built right into the economy, unable to exist independent of the material support of the Soviet Union. That means that they couldn't possibly exist. Lacking a party, a Bolshevik party, lacking an experienced revolutionary Marxist cadre. And Castro, in his latest speech, he admits all this as their weakness. Trying to maneuver one way or another, for a period, engaging in the adventure of guerrilla warfare by importing guerrillas into Latin America, that failed. Then, putting all their chips on the 10 million ton harvest, that didn't come to fruition. And they're in a very difficult position. Now, we have always criticized the Cubans for not proceeding to establish the institutionalized form of workers' democracy. I believe that one of the major reasons for the failure of the first, for the launching of the 10 million ton sugar campaign, and secondly for its failure, is the failure to involve the workers, those who are going to have to carry out this task, first in the elaboration of the plan and then in the carrying out of the plan. It came all from the top down. Now, I read an article in the Times the other day where Captain George something or other admits that this is a very great weakness in the whole plan. Now then, he sees then in Peru, with the elevation of the militarist power and the reforms that they're carrying through, hope that maybe here, in this direction, will come salvation for Cuba. I'd be leaning on a very slender reed. All these militarists are concerned with is establishing in Peru a better basis for the national bourgeoisie of Peru to extract greater profits for themselves, a bigger cut out of the imperialist exploitation. What is the end result? I don't know what the result is going to be in Cuba. I don't know. I hope it did. We try as much to influence the development. Which way are they going to turn now? I don't know. That can be one of the great tragedies of the generation of the Cuban Revolution. Precisely, as I say, because it lacked that most elementary necessity, an experienced cadre of Marxists, the Bolshevik Party, and the institutionalized forms of workers' democracy. We hope that the general revolutionary development on a world scale will tend to delay or halt any degeneration in the revolution. But that depends primarily, in my opinion, what happens outside of Cuba, not inside. There, they just got to hold on. They got to hold on until something happens in Latin America or somewhere else in the world.
You made a passing reference to a term which I think was involved in quite a controversial international Trotskyist movement in the late 40s and 50s. That is the term structural assimilation.
I'm going into that tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow.
Yeah, that is a controversial subject.
All right.
Of which I have my own opinion.
We can discuss the pedigree blood nature of Stalinism.
Well, Stalinism is not a proletarian tendency. It's not a proletarian current. It's not in its ideology. The whole concept of socialism in a single country, in one country, is not a proletarian, not an internationalist tendency. See, Marx viewed, Trotsky took up this whole question over and over again. But it was new with Trotsky, Marx himself, and Engels, and then Lenin in his work on imperialism. He says that the productive forces under capitalism have expanded to the point where the national barriers constitute the greatest obstruction to the further development and expansion of capitalism. And he pointed to the First Imperialist War as an indication of the attempt upon of the productive, or the break out of the strangulation of the national boundaries on the productive forces, which are becoming more international in character because they become more dependent upon the world market, both for sources of raw material, its labor power, and the market for its industry. And that socialism to counter would have to counter on a world scale. This is the source of what we call proletarian internationalism. The working class in any one country cannot establish a socialist utopia for themselves regardless of what happens in the rest of the world. That was established not by Trotsky, but by Marx and Engels and Lenin and all the Marxists. Nobody ever thought of this idea until 1924, till Stalin. And that was a reflection of the material interests of bureaucracy, not the international working class. And what does it lead to? What do you have in the communist movement throughout the world today? Do you have a proletarian internationalism? The parliamentary road to socialism, is that a proletarian tendency? Oh, Marx said that the whole question of the state, the character of the state. Is it possible to reform capitalism and bring socialism into being without overthrowing the capitalist state? If you do that, then you have to throw all of Marx out, and all of Marxism, and all of Leninism, and everything. People coexisting. The whole ideology of Stalinism is a petty bourgeois, not a proletarian ideology, beginning with socialism in a single country.
I was wondering, you mentioned that the comrades have made differences with internationally over the question of the nature of the Chinese Communist Party. Said that it had been Stalinist, but had Stalinist origins, but was now no longer Stalinist and less sensitive. And obviously that opens the possibility for bureaucratic self-reform of some sort. How did they explain that this process has happened, that yesterday they were Stalinist and they all of a sudden
weren't? Well, they really don't explain it. They really don't explain it, but they say. They say Stalinism developed on the basis of an unending series of defeats. Since the end of World War I, this is not the situation. We've had revolutionary victories. We've had the victory of the Yugoslav Revolution, the Savage and the Eastern Europeans, the Chinese Revolution, the Cuban Revolution, revolution in Vietnam. In Korea, North Korea. So you're having the period is altogether different. Instead of a period of defeat, which gave rise to Stalin, you're having a period of revolutionary advance. And that under these circumstances, it's impossible for Stalinism to develop. You see. Well, superficially, you would say, well, that's true, how does Stalin, but then you jump in. Say, what is this that you have? What is this phenomenon? Where does it fit in our scheme of things? So I have to come to the conclusion that it's Stalinist, but that doesn't settle anything to say it's Stalinist. You know, Trotsky pointed out that just as the bourgeoisie was able to rule under various political forms, the bourgeoisie ruled under a democratic republic, under the constitutional monarchy, under a military dictatorship, under fascism, a whole variety of political forms under which the capitalist class continued to rule, maintain its rule. He says, why do we exclude the possibility that under the dictatorship of the proletariat, the extension of the socialist revolution, that you're going to be confronted with also a multitude, a variety of political forms under which the working class rules? Now, isn't that what we have today? In Cuba, you have a dictatorship of the proletariat. You have a workers' state, but certainly not in the form that you have in Bulgaria, or in China, or in the Soviet Union, or in any of the other workers' states. In Romania, you've had a certain schism develop between the Romanian Communist Party and the Soviet Union. In China, they say they've reached the point of almost open warfare. Yet, both are based upon the same property forms established by a revolution, social revolution. So when you say Stalinism, it doesn't exhaust the subject. It'd be silly to say Stalinism, that disposes of the question. It doesn't. then you've got to deal with these various, all the varieties of sound as they manifest themselves. But there's one thing that characterizes all of these groups and tendencies in the ideological sphere. Socialism in a single country leads ineluctably to peaceful coexistence, and they all subscribe to peaceful coexistence. Leads to national reformism, not to international socialism. Okay. That the thing that identifies them all is their ideology and their practice. Those soundless parties that are in power and those that are not in power, the transformation of these parties into social reformist parties. You know, these parties today that call themselves communist parties are to the right, far to the right of the social democracy of the pre-World War I days. The social democracy of Kautsky and even of Bernstein doesn't even approximate the kind of revisionism and reformism that is current in all the communist parties throughout the world today. It doesn't. They stand far to the right. So they say, you've got to determine what is the thing that identifies them and wherein do they differ? To say that their soundness doesn't settle all questions, that would be stupid and foolish. But then to deny their soundness character because, you know, the epoch isn't that gave rise to Stalinism cannot be reproduced historically, is not Marxist, is not dialectical, it's thematic. It's basing yourself upon past formula. It's not using your head to think, it's using it for a half drive.
Earlier you said that a party that is national reformist bases itself on the concept of socialism in a single country is a colonist party. But wouldn't social democracy essentially also base itself on national reformism and if the degree that bases itself on socialism at all in a single country?
When the social democracy today doesn't base itself on socialism in any country, neither national, international, or anywhere else. The character of most of the social democratic parties today is they've abandoned Marxism. They don't even refer to Marx, not even on holiday occasions like they used to. Like they used to prior to World War I. No, they're not there. I will go into that. It's a very important question for the party and for the YSA. What is the perspective of revolutionary development in this country? See, you're making me give tomorrow's speech today. Is it going to be through the social democracy, the socialist party? I hesitate to even. I was going to call it a court, but it doesn't even have the vitality of a court. No, you see, they're in. Stalinism represents, of course, it has one big advantage. It's too close to identify with the Soviet Union, and that's the whole business. Tomorrow, again, we'll go into polycentrism versus monolithism, trying to establish the idea of their independence of the Kremlin. Because in a radicalization, again, you have the same problem. In a period of radicalization, what course, what direction, to what organization, what organizations are going to benefit from this radicalization? Is it going to be the most extreme? That has not been the case in history, not in the first stage. Is it going to be the Socialist Party? I don't think so. I think the Communist Party has replaced the social democracy as the reformist party in this country. You see? And so I know one of some comrades were telling me they were quite shocked, or rather surprised, not shocked. They went to a meeting and saw so many Stalinists. Why are you shocked? Even among the youth who are further ahead in their radicalization, certainly much further ahead than the general working class. It doesn't necessarily follow that when they begin to arrive at political consciousness, they leap from non-consciousness to revolutionaries. That doesn't follow. And so a certain number of them are going to be siphoned off into the Communist Party. Because they believe in coalition power. They believe in supporting peace candidates. They believe that the politicians are divided between progressives and reactionaries on one side. They haven't reached a stage of consciousness to be able to cut through. They don't think in terms of revolutionary politics, of class politics. The idea of class is completely alien to them, as it is alien to the Communist Party, so they have a common meeting with them. You see? So don't be surprised at the Communist Party, but don't be alarmed. See, we used to consider the Communist Party our main competitor. It's a competitor, but not in the same sense that it used to be. We used to consider it as a competitor for the revolutionary workers. No! I don't think so. For the reformists, for the petty bourgeois, for the doctors and the dentists and the lawyers that the Socialist Party used to have. Yeah. I have nothing against doctors, dentists, and lawyers. But they're not industrial workers, that's all. Yes. Anyway, we'll go to the parliament. We'll go into that tomorrow.
Yeah, it seems to me that trying to characterize Maoism as whether it's Stalinist or not, one cannot characterize this argument mostly on its rejection of the theory of permanent revolution, because that theory, of course, merely relates to, you know, the Bologna, the Bolshevik revolution, the Bologna war. So if that's the case, and Stalinism is basically, you know, the theory of socialism in one country, we think that if China, I mean Maoism at least, well, it's not clear yet whether they actually argue against socialism in advanced countries in the sense of actually selling them out or, you know, actually denying that there should be, you know, revolution in those countries so as to preserve Chinese revolution. So how can we actually characterize it as Stalinism?
Well, I think I said we don't judge them only by what they say, but by what they do. See. We don't judge tendencies by what they say, especially by what they say of themselves. But by what they do. In Indonesia, which was a test case for their theory of uninterrupted revolution, they supported Sukarno. They opposed the idea that the Indonesian Communist Party was numbered some 2 million more members, the biggest Communist Party outside of the of those parties that are at state power. A country which is rotten ripe for the socialist revolution. And a country in which even the democratic tasks which have not yet been fulfilled by the colonial bourgeoisie, the so-called democratic revolutionist Sukarno, can only be achieved under the leadership of the working class in alliance with the peasantry. On the same pattern that the Russian Revolution took place under the leadership of the working class. They inverted the whole thing. They said Sukarno represents the patriotic national bourgeoisie. The next stage in the revolution in Indonesia is not the socialist revolution, not the establishment of a worker state, not the dictatorship of the proletariat, but the democratic republic, you see, which ostensibly has been achieved in the revolt of the Indonesian people against Dutch imperialism, you see. And so they subordinated the movement to Sukarno. And the result was a terrible defeat and the destruction of the Indonesian Communist Party. In Pakistan, they support, what's his name? Khan, yeah. Because they've established more or less friendly relations. The determination of the Maoists and whether they're in opposition or whether they support any national bourgeoisie is what are the relations between that country and China, you see. So again, their primary motivation is the interest not of the development of the world revolution, which is the only salvation for China as well as for Cuba, as for the Soviet Union, but preservation of the privileges and power of the Chinese bureaucracy. The Chinese support peaceful coexistence, not only support it, but practice it. They pride themselves that they were the originators of the Panchashila, the five principles of peaceful coexistence at the Bandung Conference in 1955, was it? So when their deeds, you see, confirm their views on the question of building socialism in a single country, the big leap forward, what is that? That was the adventure of attempting to establish communism. They said we could leap over the stage of socialism in China and leap right to the stage of communism by building backyard furnaces and the big leap forward. The big leap forward is a big catastrophe. So it was a leap into the stratosphere. Mao Lander was with his feet firmly planted in the sky. And it was one of the primary causes of the Cultural Revolution, the big purge that took place in China. No, we don't judge people by what they say, but what they do. You ask one question, is there anybody else on this side? All right, we'll get back to you. I'm trying to get around to those that haven't asked questions. Was it? Dorcher is dead. No, I don't think the majority in the international holds a Dorcher our position. They don't see, their position is contradictory. Because in the last resolution, they openly call for a political revolution in China. The resolution on the Cultural Revolution. See, what happened in this they don't go, even Deutscher was beginning to change his position of self-reform, the bureaucracy reforming itself. But they don't hold a Deutscher, I do know. The comrades must have been very confused when confronted with the resolution, the draft resolution we submitted, and the amendments printed right alongside. You recall that? It was printed in the interval. I know, I was confused. I couldn't make head or tail out of it. How did such a thing happen? See, we wrote the resolution, and then they proceeded to amend it. The amendments were longer than the resolution. We deliberately wanted a small, short resolution, sharp, incisive, and clear. So they rounded all the corners and made everything ambiguous and made everything... We don't like resolutions. We like resolutions that say what they mean and mean what they say. We don't like resolutions that can be interpreted by a dozen different people in a dozen different ways, you see. In fact, this is a centrist tendency to do that. Centrism rounds things, muddies everything up. I'm sorry, I can only say what I think. You know, I've gotten to the age where I've given up any ambition. I have no ambition. Either to be any kind of a big revolutionary leader. I'm an advisor now. If anybody asks for my advice, they give it. And Mary knows, you see. She accuses me of becoming crotchety in my old age. I say, no, in my old age, I've developed a habit of saying what I think. I'm not so much concerned about hurting other people's feelings. It's not so important to me anymore. The important thing to me is clarity. Is how much can I teach and what can I teach the younger generation of revolutionaries who are going to have to grapple with these problems? I can only teach them this thing. Don't accept anything on anybody's face. Don't accept formulas. Don't accept cliches. New phenomena require new approach, new problems require fresh thinking. And so I always try to find the Achilles heel in order not to score a point, I don't give a damn about that, but to introduce some clarity, some theoretical clarity, which possibly, I hope, can avoid political error. And one of the things that arouses my ire are resolutions which say everything to everybody and nothing to nobody. I don't like those resolutions. Let them be shorter. Let them be clearer. Let them be sharper. Let them be more incisive. So somebody reads it, say, yes, by God, well, at least we know what these people think. Now let's see, we'll wait to see what they do. Somebody, oh, you. You comment.
Yeah. Certain terms among the ultra left, including the Guardian and Gloss and whatnot.
What Guardian?
I think both of them are better fed.
One of my understand has been liberated. Liberated from what? I don't know. I just look forward to the day that we'll be liberated from the Guardian. For a new force. In fact, I can give them a slogan around which they can rally their new force. Frustrates of the world unite, you've got nothing to lose but your neurosis. That's the liberated Guardian and their new force, Kim Il-sung. You know, Kim Il-sung, the North Koreans, are going through the same process that the Chinese went through in the Cultural Revolution. That is, they're trying to elevate Kim Il-sung into a deity. And this deity will stand somewhere on the totem pole a little higher than Mao. At the beginning, they published a biography in North Korea of Kim Il-sung, and they sent out not one, but three copies each person. Three copies we used to get from Peking, we only get one copy. Mao's thought. Here we got three copies. That wasn't sufficient for the Guardian. The Guardian is going to republish it in its own name. You can get as many copies, free, of that political biography of Kim Il-sung as you want by simply sending a postcard to North Korea. But they're going to publish it, and this is going to be the base. No. No, it's an exercise in futility. I have no objection to them doing it. It'd be just as fruitful as what they're doing otherwise. but so far as contributing anything to the development of a socialist movement, even Irving Bynum, Kim Il-sung, and the liberated, whoever is the guru of the liberated Guardian, won't do it. We had just had a report from Tariq Ali. He visited North Korea. And he was asked today in the course of his visit to make some speeches to the Korean army, to the workers' meeting, and so forth and so on. And he did. He spoke of the heroic role of the Korean workers and soldiers in the war against American imperialism in Korea, and it was, and of their great assistance to the Vietnamese revolutionary fighters in Vietnam and so forth and so on. He made this speech a number of times. And so he says that at one point, one of his guides approached him and says, Comrade Ali, he says, how does it happen that in his speeches you never mentioned Kim Il-sung? He says, well, I didn't know Kim Il-sung was on the fighting line in either North Korea or don't you know that all the victories that we have to record come precisely because of the great contribution of Kim Il-sung? Without that we couldn't have... Well, it's the sort of iconization, the sort of that's revolting to a revolutionist. And that's what they're trying to do, to build them up. So that Garden is going to build Kim Il-sung. I'm sure the American workers are going to rally around some flag. It won't be Kim Il-sung. I can assure you of that. Okay, we got time for one more question? One more question. All right.
What would we characterize China as, a degenerate set or a deformed?
No, we characterize it as deformed. We take as our model of a healthy workers' state the state as it issued in 1917 as a result of a social revolution taking place under the leadership of a Marxist revolutionary party, the Bolsheviks, on the basis of a revolutionary program and mobilizing the workers and peasants of Europe in revolutionary action to overthrow both feudalism and capitalism and to establish a dictatorship of the proletariat under a new form of government called the Soviets, the Workers and Soldiers Council of the Soviet Union. That is the state form, the most democratic form ever known in history. The rule of the working class under its own dictatorship through institutionalized forms of workers' democracy. Now, we said that was a healthy workers' state, even though, you know, the nationalization of property in the Soviet Union did not come about right after the Bolsheviks took power. It was a year later that they proceeded with the nationalization. And even in 1921, they reverted to the new economic policy where they had to reintroduce capitalism in their property relations. But the program of the party, we said, this is a workers' state because both in their program, in their action, in their history, in their tradition, these are Marxist revolutionists, these are internationalists. And therefore, this state, in its development, inevitably, under the leadership of this party, must be a workers' state. Now, that's not what happened in China. In 1949, when the Chinese CP took power, they said, we are not establishing a workers' state. We are not abolishing capitalism. We are reforming capitalism. We are establishing, we are maintaining capitalist property relations. The state is not a workers' state, it's a people's democratic republic, or people's republic, remember that. It's a new form of a state, you see. It's not a socialist state. That will come only later, much later, after a process of evolution, after we go through all the stages of the bourgeois democratic revolution, the organization, the party, the struggle of the workers, and then the overthrow of capital. Of course, the whole process was speeded up by virtue of the fact that they could not even consummate the bourgeois democratic tasks without overthrowing the bourgeois property relations. And so it took place not on the basis of the theory of stages. The revolution in China, as the revolution in Cuba, proceeded on the basis of the theory of permanent revolution. The party was completely bureaucratized. They proceeded to arrest and annihilate the genuine revolutionary internationalists in China from the very beginning. You had no democratic party, and you don't today. And so the state that issued from this was not a healthy workers' state. It had its deformations. It was not democratic. It did not have Soviet. It did not have workers' and peasants' councils. It did not have institutionalized forms of workers' democracy. It didn't, and it doesn't, and it won't, unless there's a political revolution in China. So it's deformed. These are the deformations that were built into the Chinese Revolution by virtue of the fact it was a Stalinist party that led the revolution. Okay.